Welcome to In the Hive, a show that looks at the issues and ideas that tie the Greater Salt Lake Valley together. I'm Emily Means, and today on the show, we're looking at a hot topic, record-breaking temperatures in Utah this summer, and more specifically, some of the ways this heat is affecting local public health. Although we've experienced some cool, breezy days this week, it's hard to forget the recent upper 90 and 100-degree weather in Utah and across the West. With trash cans melting in Phoenix, Arizona, and residents of Portland, Oregon needing air conditioning when they haven't before. Today on the program, a conversation with Peter Hebertson from Salt Lake County Aging and Adult Services about the vulnerability of older adults to heat-related illness, and later, KCPW producer Ross Chambliss speaks with Ben Holcomb with the Utah Division of Water Quality about algal blooms. But first, for a closer look at rising temperatures, I spoke with Randy Graham from the National Weather Service in Salt Lake City, who told me about the effects of extreme heat on Utah's environment and on the health of the state's people.
Okay, my name is Randy Graham, and I'm the meteorologist in charge at the National Weather Service here in Salt Lake City.
So you kind of oversee everything that's going on weather-wise in Salt Lake, and seems like it's been extra hot this summer. Are there data to support that it's actually been hotter, or can we just not take the heat?
No, it's actually been hotter. We just had our hottest July on record, actually, here in Salt Lake City. And we have going back over about 140 years of data, so it definitely was anomalously hot this July and June as well. We were on pace to have one of our warmest summers on record.
How did those temperatures compare to, the past decade?
Yeah, it's interesting if you look at the trends over the past several decades. One of the things that we've seen is really an increase in the overnight low temperatures. As an example, back in the 1970s, we averaged about four nights a summer where the low temperature was 70 degrees or greater. By the 90s, it was 11 nights a year. 2000 to 2009, it was 16. And since 2010, we've averaged 24 of those. So it's really noticeable that we're not cooling off at night as much as we used to.
Do you think the heat is due to climate change, or does Utah cycle through these highs and lows in temperature?
Well, there's certainly cycles that we go through, in the atmosphere where you're going to have periods that are above normal and periods below normal. I think the heat that we're seeing is so prolonged and over such a long period, we're not really seeing the cool cycles. If you look at our, top 10 warmest summers, they're almost all in the last 20 years, which is pretty remarkable. So certainly there's a climate change aspect to it that's driving it. Also, I think locally in Salt Lake City, there's a part of it is because of the urban area has grown so much. There's a lot more concrete and metal to retain heat, and there's also a lot more point sources releasing moisture into the air, like from air conditioners and that sort of thing. And where you're a little bit more moist, you retain that heat at night a little bit more. So it's a combination of things, but certainly climate change is probably the big culprit.
A lot more people in Salt Lake, too.
That is for sure. Yeah, and you can go around, and it's not just Salt Lake. If you looked at St. George, you see similar type trends with their low temperatures of 80 degrees or greater at night has really increased a lot since the 1970s as well.
Let's talk about some of the environmental effects of extreme heat. We've seen a beautiful blossoming algal bloom in Utah Lake this year. And last, what are some effects you've noticed that are specific to the heat?
Yeah, there's definitely impacts associated with the heat aside from the human factors. And from an environmental perspective, you bring up a good one. The algal blooms, those are really an issue when you're hot and stagnant. You don't have a lot of wind. And then, of course, there's a fertilizer component of it that getting into the waterways and such. But when you're in these heat waves, you're under a big ridge of high pressure, which means the winds are usually light. So when you have these prolonged periods of very warm temperatures, you're not cooling off at night. It makes the conditions pretty ripe for those kind of things to develop.
Right. What about water supply and floods? We've seen some flooding recently in Salt Lake, also in St. George, I believe.
Yeah, there's been we've had a fair number of flash flood events this summer during the monsoon. As far as water, the big issue is earlier runoff. If you start running off the snowpack earlier in the season, it has an impact on our water supply, because then you start drawing down that water from the reservoirs. It's a water management issue. So earlier runoff is not a positive thing for us. We want to hold that snow a little bit longer and have it run off later. But what we're seeing is earlier runoff periods. And then on the other side, our fire weather seasons are increasing in length because we're you know, melting off the snowpack earlier, and then we're having warm temperatures longer into the fall. So the extent of the fire weather season has grown a little bit as well. So that's another impact of the heat you can consider.
So we had pretty good snowpack this year, right? A good snowfall during the winter, but you're just saying that we ran out of it quickly.
Yeah, this year was not bad in that regard. We had a great snowpack. The biggest snowpack we had in the high elevations in a long time, you know, bigger than 1983 when we had the big floods. And we held that well into the spring. So this year that wasn't an issue, but just gradually over time, we've seen these earlier runoff periods and longer fire weather seasons. But this year was an exception to that.
So looking down the road a few years or maybe even a few decades, how will increased temperatures affect Utah's environment at a macro level?
Yeah, it's a real challenge for us. We're fortunate that there was a lot of foresight to build such a good reservoir system in Utah many years ago. So locally, we have a really good reservoir system to maintain some water supply. But as the population grows along the Wasatch Front, it's going to be a concern as far as are we going to have enough water for that population. And if we have issues with earlier runoff and, you know, lower snowpacks, like you mentioned, we go into these cycles where we have drought periods. We've had some really bad snow years in the last 5 years. You know, we really hadn't had a big snowpack since 2011. It becomes a concern pretty fast for us as far as water supply goes.
So what do we do about that? I want you to solve all of our water issues right now, Randy.
Yeah, that is a big problem that we're going to have to deal with, you know, as a state for certain.
Will we be seeing more rain than snow?
You know, I think, yeah, more rain than snow, certainly over time. That's the trends, you know, from the climate scientists. They would indicate that our snow level, you know, it becomes a little higher up the mountain, and that we have more rain events in the valleys, certainly, than we have historically. It's a concern for the ski industry here. I know they've been looking into it as far as what the impact may be decades down the road on the lower portion of the ski resorts, on their snowpack and that sort of thing. They're watching it really closely, I know. So that's definitely a concern for our snowpack going forward.
Well, let's take a look at the people perspective here, not just the skiers who will be impacted by lack of snowpack. But the CDC says that 620 people on average die each year from heat-related illness. So who are the most vulnerable populations to heat, and what are some of the dangers of extreme heat?
Yeah, heat is a really sneaky killer. You know, we think of tornadoes and hurricanes and floods, and there's very dramatic imagery, and there's great societal impact and costs associated with the destruction caused by those events. Heat's kind of a silent killer. It kills more than floods, hurricanes, and tornadoes combined in an average year by a fair amount. And that 600 is just direct heat-related fatalities. And there's actually another 750, what are called excess deaths is what they call it, so above the normal mortality rate, how much more mortality you have during a heat event than you would during a regular day. And so the people that are most vulnerable are people with cardiovascular issues, respiratory issues. The elderly are very vulnerable. And so a lot of times the heat-related deaths actually go down as a cardiovascular or respiratory issue and are not directly attributed to heat. So the number is actually higher than 600. And so those are the most exposed populations, certainly, that need to take precautions when we're going to deal with hot weather.
Do you know what the number's like in Salt Lake Valley?
Do not have a direct number for Salt Lake Valley. We have worked with the Salt Lake County Health Department, and we're able to identify that during these heat waves, there is a spike in mortality in Salt Lake Valley that is noticeable. And the one thing about heat is it's cumulative. It's like when we have these inversion events in the winter, we all know it's a cumulative effect. By the time you get to day 4 or 5, people's throats are scratchy, your nose is irritated. This heat is cumulative as well. So when you start stacking up many days in a row, it's harder for your body to recover when you deal with it day after day after day. And so then you start seeing the impacts with these folks with respiratory issues or cardiovascular issues, and the elderly start having issues in going to the emergency room and such.
So it's not just that one hot day that might lead to a raised mortality rate.
No, it's not. And one of the really big things about heat events is the overnight low temperatures. If you don't get cool at night, you can't recover. The body doesn't recover. So on these nights when we're staying above 70 degrees, if you don't have air conditioning, your body's not likely going to be fully recovered from the previous day's heat. And so also, if you have swamp coolers and it's very humid, like during a monsoon event, and the swamp cooler is not as effective, it doesn't maybe get as cool in your house, and so maybe you don't recover, the body doesn't recover quite as much, and you do this day after day, it starts to take a toll on your body.
Well, let's talk about some people who do this day after day, people whose jobs entail being in the sun all day. I'm thinking of construction workers on I-15 or farmers. What kind of effects are they seeing? What is the heat doing to them?
Yeah, they have a real, you know, kind of a, it's almost an acute issue for them, especially if they are able to cool off at night, because they're really exposed and vulnerable to the heat. You need to take breaks, you know, when you're out in that kind of heat. And they'll always recommend that you don't work, you know, during the hottest time of the day, which isn't possible for some people in those kind of jobs. And they just have to make sure they're getting fluids and they're, you know, they should be getting breaks so that they can recover as much as possible throughout the day so they don't overexert themselves. But it definitely takes a big toll on your body working in that heat day after day.
Fall's coming up soon, but I want to look ahead to next summer. Will it be even hotter? And how does the Weather Service predict these heat waves? How far out can they be predicted?
Now, that's a great question. One thing about heat waves is they are pretty predictable because they occur when we have a ridge of high pressure over us. And ridges of high pressure are quite predictable. We may not be able to tell you if it's going to be 107 or 105 a week out, but we can tell you that it's going to be really abnormally hot a week out oftentimes in these kind of events. It's very different than like winter storms, which are much less predictable. And sometimes you're a day out and you're still not sure if we're going to get 4 to 8 inches of snow or 6 to 12 inches of snow. You're kind of, you know, it's a much trickier. Heat events, we can talk about them far in advance. And we're trying to work with the Salt Lake County Health Department and other health departments in the state to give them a heads up to say, hey, next week, you know, 7-8 days from now, we're going to have a big heat event. And that can help with messaging. That can help with them talking to folks to open cooling centers and start getting the word out to those vulnerable populations ahead of time that they may need to take precautions. They may need to go someplace to cool down and that sort of thing. So these events, on the shorter term, are pretty predictable. As far as seasonal type forecasting going a year out, that's a much trickier problem. There's a lot of things that influence the seasonal weather, and that things like, you know, we all hear about El Nino and La Nina, those kind of things have an impact. But there's all these other oscillations, as we call them, or other things going on in the atmosphere that have an impact as well. And it's like a bunch of waves overlapping, and sometimes they line up and you get a big, you know, a high, and other times they line up and you get a big low. So I would say right now, if you're looking out to a year ahead or something like that, you just can't bet against it being warm, because that's what we've been year after year after year.
How can communities prepare for these high temperatures, and what should people not do when it comes to hot days?
Well, that's a good question. I think from a community perspective, it's really about how do you get the word out to the vulnerable population. And one thing that in Salt Lake County has been done is they've created this really slick website. You can get to it on the Salt Lake County Health Department webpage that has the location of all the cooling centers. And you can put in your address, and it'll show you where the cooling centers are in your area, whether they be a library or a center where they'll let you come in and take a break and get out of the heat and that sort of thing. I think those kind of tools can be effective if they can get them to the right people. And so I think that's one thing that communities can do. And I'm sorry, what was the follow-up to that?
What should people not do when it comes to hot days?
When you're on a hot day, the thing you really want to avoid is being out and overexerting yourself in the heat of the day. Because as I mentioned, if you don't recover overnight, if it's still warm overnight, then you just carry that impact into the next day. And if it's another hot day, you're starting off at a poor spot. So really taking it easy during the hot part of the day. Making sure you get your lots of water, of course, you know, the standard kind of thing, light colored clothing if you're going to be outside. Those are the things you need to do. Is you don't want to go, you know, jogging at 2 p.m. and that sort of thing. Even if you're healthy, you know, that's going to have an impact on you.
Randy Graham from the National Weather Service, thank you so much for talking with
me. Oh, my pleasure. Thank you for having me.
That was Randy Graham, meteorologist in charge of the National Weather Service in Salt Lake City. Want to learn more about historic weather data, forecast models, weather news, or safety? Go to kcpw.org for links to more resources. We're going to take a quick break, and we'll be right back.
There are some sounds that just go with summer. The sizzle of the grill, the crack of the bat, the splash from a pool. But there's also the ever-present sound of public radio, backdrop to so much of your summertime experience. Right now, KCPW needs your help to make its annual summer fundraising campaign a success. Please help us keep this station humming. Make a gift today at kcpw.org, and thank you.
Hello, this is Jason Perry, director of the Hinckley Institute of Politics. The Hinckley Institute is dedicated to engaging students in transformative experiences and providing political thought leadership. Each spring and fall semester, the Hinckley Institute hosts dozens of forums featuring local, national, and global leaders on important political topics. If you miss a forum, you can catch it on the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour, every Wednesday at 10 a.m. and Saturday at 9 a.m. on KCPW.
This is In the Hive. I'm your host, Emily Means, and if you're just tuning in, today we're exploring local heat effects. According to the Centers for Disease Control, people with disabilities and chronic medical conditions, children, athletes, and pets are among those who frequently suffer from heat-related illnesses. Another at-risk group from high temperatures? The elderly, and especially homebound seniors and those who don't have a big support network. To help alleviate some of the potentially dangerous side effects, Salt Lake County's Meals on Wheels program has been delivering fans to older folks who just can't beat the heat. I spoke with Peter Hebertson from Salt Lake County Aging and Adult Services about why higher temperatures can be problematic for seniors and how you can help your neighbors stay cool. What are the specific concerns of the elderly when it comes to high temperatures?
Sure. I mean, there's a lot of different concerns we have for seniors or any at-risk population when it comes to heat. One is people with certain medical conditions can be impacted by the heat. So if they have a neurological disorder, sometimes the heat can cause more problems. We get quite a few phone calls on people that don't have proper cooling in their homes. Sometimes the family's out of town because of summer. I mean, you just never know. So there's always issues that come up when it comes to this time of year and what we can do to help our seniors.
So why are seniors more affected by the heat?
You know, as we get older, sometimes we lose some functions of our body. Sometimes our body fat decreases or increases. Sometimes we're just not as efficient. And so that can impact people differently than a healthy younger adult. So it just depends on what types of issues that individual is facing.
So what kind of services does your office provide to these people?
So our services in general, we have a lot of different services. We have a nutrition program we call Meals on Wheels. I'm sure most people have heard about that. And that's a program for people that are over 60 that are unable to leave their homes any longer. And we deliver about 1,300 meals a day. The good part about that is we have eyes on those individuals. So those are the people we know to take the fans to, right? We know that we're in there. We can see if they don't have proper heating or cooling, and we can try to address those needs. We have our Rides for Wellness program, or it's a senior transportation program. And that's where we take seniors 60 and older who have no other means of transportation, really to and from their medical appointments. And this is a very important program. We provide about 55,000 trips a year to help seniors get to their doctor's office. Again, that ties in with heat or any kind of weather condition, because we want to make sure that we get those individuals seen. If you get them to their doctors, that helps prevent a lot of future problems.
So is this mostly a concern for the elderly in low-income communities, or where apartments or housing doesn't necessarily have those AC units?
Well, I think most of our senior housing and nursing homes and assisted livings, they're okay. This really does impact low or even moderate income individuals who live in their own places. So if you're on a fixed income of $2,500 a month, even though you own your own house, by the time you're running your utilities, your water, your air conditioning, that can be very expensive for people. So they have some decisions to make. And so we'll also help connect them with other programs that may lower their property taxes or may actually help subsidize some of their utility costs. So we have information on all of those programs.
Can you talk about some of the ways the heat does affect the elderly? Are we talking about heat stroke or, I don't know, fatigue?
You know, it can be in a lot of different ways. Certainly heat stroke is one. And that's why, you know, the standard thing is to try to stay cool and drink lots of water. I cannot stress for folks that are on a lot of medication to make sure they stay hydrated, because if you lose the hydration, then your medication does not work properly. So heat stroke is one. Dehydration is one. Isolation is one. Sometimes it's just too hot for people to get out. So maybe they're not attending the local senior center. It's hot to get out to their local faith-based community. So it tends to kind of socially isolate people, and we know that's not necessarily a great thing either.
The National Weather Service reported that this July was the hottest July on record. Have you seen an uptick in requests for fans this month?
You know, I think we always see an uptick whenever, especially whenever we're a hot stretch.
Right.
And we always have a very good response from the community whenever we put our pitch out. I really marvel at the people who come in and bring 12, 15, 20 fans. And we can only take new donations. We can't take used ones because we don't know if they're safe any longer. And so the community really steps up and helps us, and then we keep them on hand in case we find somebody who needs one.
So fan donations, what else can less affected populations do to help?
Well, I think the key thing that I'm always preaching, because, you know, Salt Lake County Aging Adult Services can only do so much, and sometimes our resources are limited. So it really is keeping an eye on your neighbor. If you have a senior neighbor and you don't know them, get to know them, because sometimes taking their garbage can out, making sure that their lawn's getting shoveled, particularly in the winter. I mean, winter's a whole nother topic
right.
of dangers that we could talk about. But, you know, to go out and help them shovel off their driveways and walks, these things can be very harmful to an individual. They could slip, fall, have a fracture. So we're always encouraging folks to really just keep the eye on the neighbor. If you're a member of a faith-based group, look at the seniors in your home. Excuse me, in your congregation. And, you know, if they're stopping coming to church or if you notice a change, reach out to them and see what's up. Because sometimes if we can get services or ideas in early, that allows us to support people to live in their own homes or apartments.
Do you have any recommendations on how to stay cool if you don't have AC? I know a lot of people want to cook. They want to use a stove, heats up a house immediately.
Yeah, I mean, If you don't have access to AC, again, what they say is make sure you drink a lot of water, make sure you're trying to keep your place as cool as possible. All of our senior centers, we have 17 throughout Salt Lake County, they all have air conditioning, and most of them have transportation. So if your apartment's too hot, you can get a hold of us at a number we'll give at the end of the show and make sure that we can connect you with them, because you can go to a senior center and not only stay cool, but they have meals and activities. These are places that have a lot of good programming and make friends, and they're really actually pretty nice.
Why do you think some people don't reach out for help?
Now, we are going through a change. You know, we had our Great Society generation, and these were the people that went through the Depression and the war, and they were very service reluctant. And so these people are vastly independent. And as that shifts into more of the baby boom population, we are seeing people a little more willing to reach out and ask for help. But, you know, they don't want to be a burden. They don't want to be a burden on their friends, their families, their church. The older you get, the more fearful you're going to become of maybe having to go to an institutional facility like assisted living and a nursing home facility. The whole goal of our agency is to help people age in their own homes. So it's really better if people reach out early, kind of tell us their story, let us know what's going on, and then we can make some recommendations.
So, Peter, if people do need help, how can they contact your office?
The best way to contact us, and I make sure we keep our phones answered, is 385-468-3200.
Peter Hebertson, thank you so much for talking.
Thanks so much.
A few weeks ago, if you were out near Utah Lake soaking up the sunshine and trying to cool off by the water, you probably saw something resembling pea soup. Blue-green water with clumpy sheets of slime floating on the surface. Ben Holcomb, the Biological Assessment and Harmful Algal Bloom Programs Coordinator with the Utah Division of Water Quality, spoke with KCPW producer Ross Chambliss about algal blooms that have been thriving during the summer weather.
So I think you're referring more specifically to the cyanobacteria that we're seeing more frequently across our water bodies throughout the state. We're seeing the intensity, the magnitude of their growth on a handful of lakes on a larger scale. So what they are is a group of bacteria that act like algae. So they act like plants by using photosynthesis through the sun to gain their energy. And so with this hotter weather, that's when they thrive. They can outcompete other algae. They can outcompete the macrophytes whenever it gets hot. I mean, they have a higher tolerance for heat than other organisms.
So now this has been getting a lot of attention these last couple years, specifically with Utah Lake. Is this growth of harmful algal blooms in Utah Lake and the Jordan River in the summer, is this a new thing or has this always been happening?
Well, it's probably occurred at some level throughout time. These are a natural organism. We've looked through the sediment layer of Utah Lake, and from what we can tell, they weren't as pervasive historically as they are currently. So we are seeing that trend, just like we're seeing that trend globally. Globally, they're experiencing this same problem of these cyanobacteria dominating a system, overtaking it, and, you know, some levels producing toxins that are harmful to people. And so that's why we're paying a closer attention to this type of phenomenon because of its health effects, especially.
How does this become a health concern for people? What kind of activities put humans in danger when these harmful algal blooms occur?
The public is most at risk through recreation. So if they're out there, primary recreation, which is immersion into the water, head and face, and then potentially ingesting some of that water, that's the most direct route with untreated water. And then there are areas where our source water, drinking water source water, is compromised by these toxins. But these facilities, the facilities we have in our state, are up to date and they know how to process when this occurs.
Now, a lot of the water that comes out of Utah Lake and in the Jordan River gets used for agriculture, right? People put it on their gardens, on their crops. Sometimes it's given to animals. What risk does that pose?
There's a lot of potential risks. There's a lot of unknown risks. There's a lot that needs to be learned with the secondary irrigation. People, like you said, they use it for a wide range of uses, and that's not necessarily known to the irrigation water providers. They probably have some idea of what occurs, but once they provide the water, it's kind of out of their hands, and it's really up to health officials to kind of warn residents on the best use of that water.
Could this phenomenon become bigger? I mean, could this become a regular concern if we continue to experience hotter summer temperatures as scientists expect?
Yeah. Utah Lake, for example, it is pretty much a regular thing. It could possibly be worse. China is experiencing horrible blooms. The state of Ohio is experiencing horrible blooms where they're experiencing them into December. And they're at the same latitude as us. So it's just a matter of time if we don't do something about that.
That's my next question, is what can we do about it? What can we do to prevent these toxic outbreaks happening in the future?
To make the largest effect for us locally is to reduce the amount of nutrients, that is nitrogen and phosphorus, that are feeding these blooms. So we've been, as a society here, we haven't been treating our water bodies as important as they really are. And so we're going to have to really buckle down and look at the sources of these nutrients, nitrogen and phosphorus, and do our best to limit the amount that's going into our water bodies.
That was Ben Holcomb, Biological Assessment and Harmful Algal Bloom Programs Coordinator at the Utah Division of Water Quality. How are you staying cool in the heat? Weigh in the In the Hive podcast link posted on KCPW's Facebook page, KCPW 88.3, or feel free to email us at comments@kcpw.org with your feedback and questions. Thanks to the KCPW team for their support of this show, and thank you for tuning in. You can find podcasts of this program on our website, kcpw.org. Up next is Both Sides of the Aisle. I'm Emily Means. Thanks for listening.